Awesome. All right, everybody. Welcome to News in the Money World. My name is Darcy Ungaro, and this guy over here is Rupert Carlion. How are you, Rupert?
I'm very good. I've just had two other webcasts this morning, so this is I've got lots of content to talk about today.
Fantastic. No, it's good. Well, we probably should get onto it because there is one, two, three, four, five things that we definitely need to dig into. Let's start with locally what's happening in New Zealand. Double dip recession. So we're all now doubly dipped and depressed here in New Zealand, and that's affecting households. It's definitely affecting sentiment. I work with families that are upgrading or trying to upgrade their home. They're trying to put kids through school with usually two incomes just to make it work. And it's been a struggle for a long time. And I think it's probably a mix of knowing that interest rates are going to stay higher for a little bit longer and a little bit of anxiety around the source of income coming into households that I pick up on the most. So that's kind of the micro that I'm looking at most of the time. But in terms of the macroeconomic landscape, certainly feels like we are well and truly into this zone. And it kind of feels almost like it's payback for the intervention in March of 2020. You have a view on that?
Yes, short answer. I think kind of, so where I've just come from, the presentation I was just in, it's becoming pretty clear as New Zealand is in a pretty ugly world of stagflation. And for people that don't understand, that means that we have a negative, low to negative growth. And pretty clear, we've now got negative growth, despite the fact that we've got an extra massive inflation, a massive of people coming in. But we've also got high inflation. So that's going to put the Reserve Bank, and by the end of the year, definitely the government, in a really ugly space, right? Because unfortunately, stagflation means that there could, if we can't get that inflation number down, there is going to be no room to drop interest rates. And so we're kind of, the Reserve Bank at the moment is saying interest rates aren't going to fall till 2020. I kind of used to think that was just kind of scare tactics, but increasingly when you look at that inflation data, that's what we're looking at. And so coming back to the average person here in New Zealand, things could be, it could be a pretty tough 12, 24 months, right? Where we're sitting there looking at uncertainty around jobs, kind of recession likely to continue, but unfortunately, and high inflation, so things are going to keep on getting more expensive. And unfortunately, maybe we don't get the relief on mortgage rates that we all thought we would, which is only going to make things a little bit harder. So, yeah, I'm Mr. Negative, so we've talked about this a little bit, but I increasingly nervous about what the current state of the New Zealand economy looks like and actually what that means for everyday people.
Yeah, I echo that. I felt like that for a long time, so I'm kind of feeling more positive now because I kind of feel like I've come through the other end.
At least everyone else is now agreeing.
Yeah, everyone else. So I feel good that, hey, maybe I'm not crazy, maybe I'm right, but I don't know. That's not really enough. It's not really enough. You still, I kind of think that, well, it's probably during these times that you get shaken up a little bit, right? And you're forced to change lanes. Sometimes you're forced to change jobs or shut down a business or start something new. It's incredibly disruptive. It's challenging. It's difficult. But this is kind of part of growing something as you go through these creative destruction times where something dies, is planted, new life gets brought out of it. It always does. It seems like we've been kept from it, though, haven't we? Like we've been kept from it when we were going through the insanity of 2010. Now paying for it is really quite a mess, and it's complicated because we have the fiscal response and then we have the monetary response. So we have these two levers, forward and backward, that both the central bank and the government are delicately trying to pull whilst not looking at what each other is doing. So it's kind of like you have somebody operating the brake pedal and the accelerator, somebody steering, but they're not allowed to talk to each other. And that's good, but it's also bad. And so it kind of leads me to the next kind of topic, which is if you've been watching the political stories through the media, through the bias, of course, you can see that there is this anxiety around tax cuts, that those tax cuts effectively release more money into the economy, which if we're allowing more money to exist in the economy when the objective is actually to take money out of it, then we're stoking inflation, right? And then that makes the central bank's job harder. They have to keep on the pressure and it's higher for longer. What's the solution?
I've got no idea.
I thought you do. I thought you did.
There's only one logical answer.
What, communism?
Well, no. Given where we are right now, there is unfortunately only one answer. You cannot put an extra $4 or $5 billion into the economy right now. It is what it is, right?
But is it really putting it into the economy, or is it just leaving it in the pockets of the economy that are most likely to be productive and therefore get us
Well, there's two parts to the story, right? And so the argument from our current political masters is that it is not inflationary because they're also taking out a whole lot of costs out of the government, and therefore it's kind of fully funded. But let's be honest. Unfortunately, because of the mess they're currently in, they've actually got to get rid of 3 or 4%. They're currently running a deficit of 3 or 4% of GDP. That number has to come to zero. And so 3 or 4% of deficit is actually what's creating the inflation problem. And so by simply saying, well, actually, we're going to leave it kind of where it is because we're going to put some tax cuts through, but we're fully funding those tax cuts, so it doesn't matter. That's completely missing the point. If they want to attack inflation and if they want to attack cost of living, what they do is they take all the kind of the cuts and through that they want to do in terms of the cost out, but they don't put a whole lot more money into people's pockets. So putting into context how far this potentially has to go, and they might be wrong here. So the Reserve Bank have said that they think to get inflation under control, the unemployment rate needs to get somewhere close to kind of north of 4. We're currently sitting at about 3. That means that between 2 to 3 jobs need to go. So you kind of go like, that's the scale of what we are currently facing, right? And don't get me wrong, the cutting the bureaucracy and cutting government is not going to come even close to that. And how we're doing that, I also think is atrocious. And the impact that has on people's lives and just the uncertainty that creates. But yeah, well, sorry, turn this into a bit of a rant, but my view is if we want to control inflation, the best thing the government can do is get us back to a neutral fiscal position as soon as they can. So to my mind, just because the tax cuts are funded, that's kind of irrelevant. It's all about how do they get us back to fiscal neutral, and then after that we can start talking about tax cuts, because that's, I think, going to be the biggest impact on everyday people. Is the sooner we get inflation down, and fiscal neutrality is going to be the fastest thing they can do to do that. All the tax cuts are going to do is going to extend out how long inflation lasts.
You're right. And I guess but ultimately, when you boil it all down, you have to create productivity, right? Somebody has to invest, create something out of nothing, and actually mine wealth from this dry earth that we're stuck on, right? Like, we actually have to create abundance. And yeah,
Do we think that tax cuts improve productivity? The evidence on that is extremely sketchy at best to negative.
Yeah, you actually have, and you're going to have like a 1% access to money, and it would be amazing, right? And maybe that's the future that we get to eventually. Maybe the central bank issued digital currencies and a forward-thinking government respecting privacy. Maybe we get there. I don't know.
Countries talking about productivity and high ends, right? The things, there's an article on yesterday where it goes, well, actually, you know what? Why aren't we saying to Google or Facebook or some of these kind of big tech companies of saying, for every salary over 100 a year that you bring into New Zealand, you know what? We're not going to make that person pay tax. We can create an environment where we can bring in all of these jobs and we can do all of this stuff. And I think if productivity is our objective with tax cuts, which difficult, but there. Exactly what you said is right. Let's be super targeted. Let's be super focused on what we want and make sure that it aligns with those versus the very broad-based tax cuts that's going to kind of go and impact absolutely everyone, but it's not going to touch productivity.
Yeah.
A $15 billion program targeted at growth and focused on specific sectors. Yeah, I would argue that's potentially, it's a big set of numbers. Fuck, you want to make a difference, you got to go big, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, I think we should get the, I don't even know what the name is. What is the name for our political leaders? So Winston Peters, David Seymour, and Chris Luxon. Has anybody invented kind of like a name for them, like the something threesome or something like that yet? No one's really invented a name for them, have they?
No, not yet.
Not yet. Okay.
The only thing I can, Hipkins name running around my head, but that's not entirely fair.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we will wait. Okay. We'll come up with one for next week. Yeah.
Well, we should get them on the show anyway, and then at least give them some education, because clearly we have the answers. All right. Let's talk about, though, the U.S., because some big announcements last week with the FOMC meeting. Really interesting watching Jerome Powell walk that really, really fine line. Yeah, like a hawkish stance with distinct dovish overtones, leaving the door open for rate cuts if the unemployment started to get out of hand, effectively kind of short-circuiting the whole thing so that there was still a lot of confidence in the job market. But yeah, it's really fascinating watching Fed speak in action, because you know it's a complete lie, right? But it has to be believed, because it's all about confidence. And if the market believes it, maybe we can achieve this mythical soft landing. Your general thoughts, though, around rate cuts in the U.S.? Like, it feels like it is getting closer, and it feels like it's highly, highly convenient with the election approaching and the distance we are to that election. I'm kind of watching it because I know that probably has to go first before New Zealand goes first for some other reasons. But what do you think, Rupert? Like, do you think that we're going to see a rate cut maybe sooner than we thought?
Yeah, I think we potentially are looking at the June rate cut, which is kind of interesting, right? Because this was truly an amazing announcement when you think about it, or amazing conversation, because the things that were really higher, so versus December announcements, on December when they did their last kind of release and piece, well, not the last one, but versus the December one, since then, the growth expectations to 2024 and 2025 are higher. The unemployment expectations are lower. The inflation expectation is higher. And yet, the expectation around interest rates has not moved. And so typically, you would have expected high growth, higher inflation, lower unemployment. Boom, let's push out interest rate rises. But what's fascinating is that hasn't moved at all. And that kind of really interesting commentary around, we think basically we think we've got a really good shot at landing in the middle of that tiny aircraft carrier, and we've done an exceptional job. And I think that's where they're kind of now almost saying, cool, we think we're close to done here. We're in that end game, and we're going to bring this in for a really soft landing. And it's going to be pretty hard to see what's going to divert them off that path. But yeah, it's kind of really, really interesting, right? Because all of the data points should have suggested we push out interest rate cuts, and we actually look at a higher dot plot of where those interest rates sit and say, yeah, that was where I was absolutely shocked. But yeah, so it's going to be hard to see them walk back from that positioning. Yeah. The second point that I thought was really interesting about it, and you mentioned this before, was the commentary around the unemployment market and the unemployment rate. And the fact that they will do everything they can, not everything, but they will give a good chunk of their mandate to protecting the employment market, because consumers, at the end of the day, what's the job of the Fed? The job of the Fed is to kind of protect the stability of the financial system and make it easier for everyday people. And so they do that through controlling inflation, but also the employment market's the other really good factor, because if people are all losing their jobs and inflation is zero, then consumers are losing anyway, right? And I just found this really interesting, because very different to where we've gone in the last 3 or 4 months, where we've said, hold on a sec, we only want you to focus on inflation. You've got to get inflation down as fast as you can. And we're kind of giving up on that slightly broader mandate, which a lot of other countries in the world are going, hey, it's not just about inflation. It's about all of this other stuff. And so it is going to be interesting in saying that. New Zealand's a much trickier position because of that, the structure of our economy and where we're at, the stagflation piece that we're sitting in. But yeah, it is. I just found that dichotomy and of kind of how the Fed is talking versus the RBNZ, and also how New Zealand politicians want the RBNZ to talk, I found really interesting.
Yeah, well, a lot of stuff is shifting in that. And I just wonder even just the role of like social media in all this.
Yeah.
Like, we're having a conversation right now, and we're being either, we're praising them or we're being critical of their actions, which then, of course, it's influencing thousands and thousands of people, our conversation right now.
Of course.
But there are other people doing this, and that's influencing a conversation, which then influences the narrative, shifts public opinion, translates into political force, and it does create change. And I kind of think of these characters like, Jerome Powell and Janet Yellen, and I've been critical of them both in the past, really like highly suspicious that they could actually engineer a soft landing. But in the last little while in particular, I can't really criticize probably a lot of what they've done. It kind of actually feels like they are watching the dials really closely. They're probably doing all the adjustments they need to. And everybody has an opinion on whether it's too much or not enough because they're in pain or they're doing well, whatever their own stories are. But in aggregate, they probably are actually doing the best job they can given the situation. You know what I mean? Like, I think they're actually doing a pretty good job.
It's pretty hard to argue with how it's gone so far, to be perfectly honest. And saying that, we're not finished. So there is still a journey to go. But, I mean, yeah, I'd be the first, if we get to the end of this cycle, we're first to nominate Jerome Powell for the Nobel Prize in Economics, right? Because he has engineered the landing that no one ever expected him to come close to.
It's a shame he'll lose his job when Trump gets in.
Wow, yeah, and he will. But it's also a big shame that actually what he has achieved, if he gets there, it's a big if, is I'm dead serious around the Nobel Prize in Economics, right? He has achieved what no one in the world thought was possible, and he will not get credit for it. He will still be abused and kind of criticized for holding rates too low for too long, versus the kind of fix that he managed to engineer. So it is a pretty hard one. But I do think the flip side to that conversation and the soft landing that we were all talking about is it's kind of, and this is part of the previous conversation I just had, it's around what is the new neutral interest rate, right? So, and I think it's very present for us here in New Zealand, and particularly in your world, where are mortgage rates about to go back to, right? Because do we think that actually there's 50 points of easing? Is it 75 points of easing? Is it a small number, which actually means that, which gets us back to kind of where interest rates were 20 years ago is what we thought was the new norm. So what is normal? Everything that happened pre-2000, or is the new normal that 15-year period since, right? And so as we're thinking about our mortgage rates and as we're thinking about where it goes, I'm increasingly starting to take the view that, you know what? If I can figure out if it comes down to 5.5 or even 6%, maybe between five and six percent, I reckon that's going to be a pretty good outcome. It's going to require something pretty catastrophic economically for us to get below 5% again.
That's right. Yeah, like I look at it probably again from the household point of view when I look at people's budgets and affordability, which factors in rising cost of living over time. It factors in the loan amount that they have to carry to live in a property that is functional to raise a family in. And the average loan amount does increase over time. So if it increases at a rate which exceeds the rate of income growth, then naturally the only way to reach equilibrium between even just the decision of renting versus owning is for interest rates to drop. And with the numbers that I've done, it's more or less around 4.5%. So in other words, if interest rates at the pump, right? I'm not talking about the OCR, but if interest rates on the mortgage was 4.5%, that works because generally people will pay the same amount to rent a property versus own the property if it's about 80%. So if the cost of borrowing 80% of the purchase price, assuming 100% finance, is equal to the rent that you're paying, that's kind of neutral. And for that to balance out at the moment, I'm guessing it's probably around about that 4.5% mark. So I kind of look for that as it's probably neutral in terms of positive or negative pressure on house prices, but that's not coming from a scientific economics point of view.
That sounds logical, but what we also need to remember, right, there are two ways of looking at it. You can either cut the interest line or you can cut the borrowing line. And does that mean actually we're in for a hell of a lot more pain and house prices? And to be fair, I think we actually are seeing that. I think there was a bit of a run-up in that period to Christmas, which was caused by very low volumes and very little stock on the market. Everyone got excited and when they saw some stability, if not a slight tick up in prices in some regions. Everyone then went and put their houses on the market in January, February. And now there's more stock than there's ever been and nothing's selling, which, I mean, unfortunately, we know what that means, right? We're about to see the next leg down in property prices again.
Absolutely correct. And that's one of the implications of higher for longer as well. So even if we do see a slight reduction in interest rates with the OCR and even with the Fed over in the US, it doesn't necessarily mean that interest rates are going to return back to the level which is going to actually move the dial in households. It'll still be higher for longer, which means that there'll be higher stress. Like you see it with in the bond space as well, that if the debt coverage ratio gets too low, then things get really scary, right? And they default on their payments. And so that can happen with households as well. They default on their mortgages. It increases the likelihood of having to sell the property rather than wanting to sell the property. And as soon as you have a market that has to sell, yet people are still constrained by the ability to borrow, which they are, that's problematic in so many ways. And I don't personally believe we're going to get there, because I still believe that property is the mechanism by which new currency comes into creation. And it has to come into creation at a certain rate, again, offset by the fiscal side as well. And so there's all these interesting little complicated levers and threads that run through the New Zealand economy right now, which is quite fascinating, right?
Oh, massive. It's going to be fascinating to see, right? So it's going to be an interesting 3 or 4 years in my view.
Totally agree. Because,
my final comment on housing would be, despite everything I've just said on affordability, at the end of the day, housing is still a supply and demand game. And when you've got new people coming into the country every year who need kind of 70,000 houses to live in, and we're only building 25 or 30,000 a year, plus we've already got a backlog of 100,000 shortage.
Yep.
Unfortunately, as much as people can't afford them, prices are unlikely to come down on that basis.
Totally. So whatever people feel by hearing negative news around the property market, just invert it, because this is probably, in my view, this is the beginning of one of the best times to get into the property market, especially for pre-existing stock.
Well, I think it depends on what you're doing. Like for most people, if you are an owner-occupier, or even if you're looking to buy a residential investment property for your long-term future planning and retirement, we can all be confident that over a 15-20-year period, you'll be all right. And it's like all of these assets, right? If you're looking at it on a two-year basis, it starts to get pretty scary, and maybe not. But at the end of the day, asset class, we should be looking at it as a 15-20-year investment, and it's pretty hard to see how you can lose on that basis.
Yeah, no, I agree. Let's quickly go across the ditch. Australia, dollar went down a little bit recently, just basically due to sentiment, I guess, regarding China, their biggest trading partner. What does this mean for New Zealand?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, right? So this was an interesting article we picked up in Bloomberg last week, where the negative sentiment in Australia is getting stronger and stronger. You've kind of got more of the offshore investors are shorting Australia, so looking to sell Australia versus buy it, and that's pushed down currency, it's pushing up rates slightly, and it's been not so great for the equity markets. And the main reason for that negative sentiment is China, where everyone's sitting there going, hold on a sec, your economy is based on selling coal and iron ore into China. If China aren't going to be buying it so much, then what does that mean for the state of your economy? And I thought, great article, great perspective. But yeah, New Zealand, how much of our 35, 40% of our exports go into China? Admittedly, it's not so much for construction. It's the ag stuff, it's the food, it's the milk powder, it's the meat, it's the seafood, a lot of that stuff. So potentially not so infrastructure driven. But at the same time, if the middle class is kind of shrinking, which it kind of clearly is right now, as life gets much harder in China for everyday people, what does that mean for us? And does that mean that our kind of what we've let become our biggest market over the last 15 years is going to cause us a whole series of different issues? And so we talk about all of our own internal struggles, or that was the first half of this conversation, but we haven't even started to overlay some of that external macro stuff that I think could create an equally big problem, right? We've already seen it through the log prices, where log prices have kind of tumbled. We've seen milk prices come down to a level where actually milk kind of dairy guys are kind of the ones without much leverage, are fine-ish. Anyone with leverage or who basically bought their farm in the last kind of better part of the last 10 years are really struggling. And so, that's probably my big fear that we're not yet talking about in New Zealand, but is actually the China slowdown. And what does that mean for New Zealand?
Yeah, it seems like everything, no matter where you look, small or big, is always tied to growth. And as long as there's growth, everything's fine. As soon as there's not growth and things are constricting, that's when not only is it painful and it's hard, but systems become unstable. Political systems, society, financial systems as well. And we're not designed nothing is designed for contraction. And I think that's ultimately the macro overlay that you kind of have to put on all of these issues that we're talking about. And when we get to the topic of, hey, what's a bright spark or what's doing well, even the reason why it's doing well is probably due to what I just mentioned, where there's instability that increases over time when we're in a higher for longer environment, and that's Bitcoin. And I know that not many would have looked at Bitcoin up probably until last year as a safe haven asset, but increasingly, I think that's becoming clear in my mind anyway, that it is a form of a safe haven asset in the digital form. So let's talk about the ETF flows, because at the start of the year, we had quite a few ETFs approved, finally, reluctantly by the SEC under a bit of pressure, and that's led to serious inflows. And by inflows, let's start there. Describe to me what an inflow into an ETF is, a bit of jargon just for those that don't understand.
So do you remember an ETF, new units are created or redeemed every single day for an ETF? So if you've got lots of people trying to buy in to an ETF, the price rises. And then so what we call the market maker, which is effectively a broker, will go and create new units. Alternatively, if lots of people are trying to sell, then the price drops a little bit and then people will go and redeem units. And so when we talk about inflows or outflows, it basically means how much net new money is going into these asset classes and into these investments. And so we kind of had a quick look, did some analysis around it, and it's really interesting, right, when you look at how much money has actually gone in. So look, in total, it's been up until the end of last week, we've actually seen $10 billion in the last 2 months. Sorry, this is only to the start of February. We've seen $10 billion of inflows going to these assets, right? And that is huge. This is all US dollars. When you think about it, it is only tracking an asset which has got a $1 trillion market cap. So that's 1% of the overall asset class. Then we look at kind of some of the weekly movements and some of the things that we've seen, right? I mean, last week or 2 weeks ago now, the week of the 15th, there were $2.3 billion of new money that went into this asset class. Come back to the first week in March, there was another $2 billion of money that went into this asset class. And over the course of that week, we saw the price grow from 51 of Bitcoin to $63,000. And so I think what some of the stuff that we are seeing at the moment is a little bit of an old-fashioned liquidity squeeze. So we're seeing lots and lots of volume coming in to buy this asset class and then what kind of coming out the other side. So last week, price dropped from kind of its highs of $70,000 back down to kind of it bottomed out at about 62, 63. Guess how? What the inflows were quite significantly negative. We had $800 million of outflows last week. And so what we are seeing is the price is basically acting as a bit of a proxy for kind of inflows and outflows. In saying that, I don't quite know what happened yesterday because I don't have my flow numbers completely ready yet. Right. Whereas yesterday, what we saw was kind of with Bitcoin price jumping 10% back up to kind of $70,000.
71, yeah.
I'm assuming, hate to say it, that there was a big day of inflows again.
Sure, okay. So what you're saying then is, and this was a question that someone asked us recently, which was, you know, with this the supply of Bitcoin that is available to be gobbled up by these funds, considering it is finite and we have this infinite or potentially infinite supply coming in, you mentioned it, it's a liquidity squeeze, right? So it's very inelastic, this supply. Therefore, when unlimited demand meets inelastic supply, it just shoots price to the moon. And the inverse is possible as well. So that's one big layer of price movement that's happening underneath the pre-existing fundamentals that were already there with Bitcoin before the ETFs, which was, hey, every 4 years, we have an event called the halving, and then usually 6 months afterwards, we have significant price action, and then it kind of all settles down again. That's happened a few times in the past. Past isn't guaranteed to happen in the future, but that's independent of what's happening with the ETF. So when you merge these things together, you do kind of have a recipe for some extreme price action, which doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to go up through the moon, but it just means that there's going to be a lot more flows going in and out driving this price, right?
Yeah, I've also done some interesting research on this as well. So Citibank, and they kind of compared what is happening right now with what happened to gold when they launched a whole lot of their ETFs.
Yeah.
And gold took a lot longer to kind of scale up. I think today there's probably more on the ETF market in Bitcoin than there is in gold.
There's more in the ETF market than there is in gold, too.
I think so. In the gold ETF market.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting is, they saw exactly the same phenomenon. So they go through periods, and one of the big periods around gold ETFs was during the GFC, where everyone went into gold because at the end of the day, everyone was petrified about the traditional financial system during that period. And so, again, push the price up, liquidity squeeze, come back down. And so you are seeing for these illiquid assets as liquid assets on the ETF and on the exchanges, we will continue to see this for a little bit, this world of liquidity bubbles and liquidity traps. The flip side to that conversation, though, I would argue, potentially justifiably or unjustifiably, is that this will taper off as more and more people understand these movements. And so you're going to get people playing the liquidity game over the last, so comparing it to gold, comparing it to where that was back in 15 years ago, isn't really the same as where we are today, with the fact that today, this shocked me, this stat, 35-40% of all trading volumes on the New York Stock Exchange are ETFs. They are a massive part of the market today, right? And you've got these super sophisticated hedge funds, algorithmic, quant funds, all these guys that have kind of learning how to play the volatility game and also learning how to play in and out of liquidity traps. And so I think with the size of this asset class, it's now becoming too big for them to ignore. And actually what you find is that they will become the market makers and they will deal with a lot of this kind of liquidity and volume metric, and a volatility. It's just going to take some time, and whether that be 6 months, 12 months, I don't know, to get them to understand the trades, the patterns, and also have some confidence around what instruments to play it with as well.
Sure. So it's that information asymmetry, but over time, the market becomes more efficient. Is the theory. I mean, I guess it's quite simple when there's just one asset inside of this exchange traded fund. There's just one asset, it's Bitcoin. Yep. Not that complicated, which means that the fee should come down as well, by the way, but that's probably separate. But it probably doesn't take much for that to act as a stabilizing force, I guess what you're saying. So in the short term, we'll probably see less and less volatility over time, I guess.
I think in the short term, we'll continue to see that volatility. I think in the medium term, this will be what enables the volatility to come down. I don't think we're going to. Yeah, I'm on record of saying pretty clearly, will we get another crash? Yes. Will that crash happen? I don't know when it will happen. But yeah, we can't be naive enough to believe that we've all of a sudden solved this problem immediately.
That's right.
I do think, though, and I've said this lots of times, the ETFs are a really important step to reducing that volatility over time.
Correct. Yeah. And I guess the only thing in the back of my head that is a bit of a loose end around that part of it is, what about the actual retail investors? Who may at some stage get triggered, probably when the price reaches a certain point, like sustained all-time highs over 70, it'll probably start to register in the consciousness of a lot of everyday people, and they'll jump on their apps and they'll buy these ETFs. And so and they'll go through the learning experience that anybody in Bitcoin has gone through several times now, which is that the volatility will shake you up a little bit and you'll discover emotions that you didn't have before. And so when you overlay that on top, I guess the individual investors' flows going in and out, that's got to be a factor as well, right?
Massive. Yeah.
So time will tell. Awesome. I'm really surprised that we covered everything on our list, Rupert. Well done. Congratulations.
I don't think we had much to cover here, and I'm just looking at my timer, and we've done 38 minutes of
sweet.
I reckon high-quality chat, too.
I think it's pretty high quality. What's our hourly rate per minute on this chat? Anyway, Rupert, this has got to be pretty good. Anyway, by the way, on that, if anyone is listening, please do like and subscribe and share far and wide. It's actually really hard, and I know, because when I'm trying to learn about stuff like we're talking about, it's really hard to find New Zealand-based content with a macro focus. And I'm not disparaging to any of the other content that's out there, but like of this style, right? Like someone who's slightly deranged talking to somebody who's slightly smart, you're not going to find this anywhere else. And so when you find something good, don't keep it to yourself. Share it. Come on. So yeah, share this episode far and wide. Get your friends and family hooked into it. And onwards and upwards.
Thanks, Darcy. Well said.
Awesome. All right. See you later, everyone. Catch you next
week. Thank you. Bye-bye.